Hi, I'm Dave Summers, and welcome to AMA's Edgewise, where you will hear fresh insights from recognized thought leaders across a wide range of subject matters. AMA's Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. The AMA is a global leader in professional development and education, improving the immediate performance and long-term growth of individuals and organizations. Check us out on our website, www.amanet.org. After years of downsizing, outsourcing, and corporate greed gone wild, today's workers believe that their company no longer values them. These vulnerable and resentful feelings affect as many as two-thirds of U.S. workers who are either actively looking for new jobs or going through the motions at their current jobs. Fueled by bad management practices, this psychological recession can take a toll on your organization's bottom line. So what can we do about this problem? Drawing on what works for exceptional and profitable companies, Dr. Judith Bardwick has developed original ideas and specific strategies to regain the trust, commitment, and engagement of your employees at every level. She has compiled her insights in a new book, One Foot Out the Door, published by AMACOM, a division of American Management Association. In this book, she reveals how you can increase commitment, get more from your people, magnify your bottom line, and replace the broken spirit at the heart of your company with engagement and the passionate sense of, I'm in, let's go. Judith, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Let's just jump right into it here. In your new book, One Foot Out the Door, you claim that as many as two-thirds of United States employees are victims of a psychological recession. What is this condition, and why has it become so widespread?
Let me tell you, I actually think that the psychological recession impacts about half of the population here and in other countries. But the disaffection of employees is two-thirds or 80%. And my absolute favorite number in this subject was the 4.5 million answers to the Q12 questionnaire by the Gallup organization from 2002 to 2005. And what they found, we can summarize in the numbers 20, 60, 20. 20% of employees in multiple countries were committed to their organization, and 90% of productivity came from that 20%. 60% were not committed and, of course, not engaged. And among that group were many who had quit but who showed up. And 20% were actively disengaged, which I call boils or centers of infection. They spew out malicious views and try to infect the rest of your employees with those views. So 80% of employees in the U.S. and other countries on average are neither committed nor engaged. And that is, A, an opportunity to improve, and B, a terrible state.
Those are scary numbers. How do bad management practices perpetuate the psychological recession and aggravate its toll on a company?
Okay, let's talk about what the psychological recession is first, because we haven't introduced that, and then we'll talk about bad management. And before I start this, I have to say we are spending an awful lot of money on bad management, and this is really irksome to me. So let's start with the psychological recession, which we've said impacts roughly half the population in the United States and in other countries as well, because what's happening here is happening around the world. The psychological recession is a long term. The bottle is half empty. It is the sense, which is really scary now, that today is lousy, and tomorrow will be worse.
Just this bleakness.
Bleak. The world is full of risk and change, and I experience it as chaos, and I can't control it. My good performance doesn't help me, and nobody cares. Not my government, not my employer, not my church. Nobody. So I'm hanging in a cold wind. and nobody cares. That is the sense of a total lack of control over what happens to you. It doesn't get much bleaker than that. So this is a combination of anxiety and depression, and it is a poisonous mix. And that surely leads to the 60% who are disaffected and the 20% who are violently disaffected. How does bad management contribute to this? Well, if you are a person who feels like a psychological recession has beset you, you feel insignificant, impotent. You feel of no importance, of no significance, faceless, useless, a widget easily disposed of. What is the job of management? The key job of management is not to hit the numbers yourself. It's to hit the numbers through the apt management of the people who do the actual work. Your job is to manage people. That means to recognize them, teach them, mentor them, coach them, critique them, improve them, communicate to them that they are a resource and of value, and you know that they are there. Bad management doesn't communicate, is not transparent, is not trustworthy, commands no respect. Well, that means that the boss who you interact with directly signals to you by what they do and by what they say that you are worth less. So what I'm saying, Dave, is if managers are able to say, you know, I'm not really particularly good at this, you have a shot at improving their performance through coaching or mentoring or training, all of the above. But since people are generally promoted to management because of high levels of professional skills, an awful lot of those people, especially in technical fields, have an IQ of minus 100 in terms of emotional quotient. They may be terrific professionals, and as such, they should remain professionals, individual contributors.
Right.
But they should not be allowed to manage other people.
Exactly. Okay, we've spent an awful lot of time talking about psychological recession and talking about the negative side of this. Let's talk about remedies. Let's talk about strategies for improvement. Sure. What can a company or management within an organization, what kind of steps can they undertake to improve this?
Now, I have three suggestions or recommendations for increasing commitment and engagement. And before I go into those, I would say, on average, organizations will do 30% better in financial terms than peer organizations if they have highly committed and engaged employees and the comparison group do not. In addition, your share price or your total return on equity or your total return to investors, if you have highly committed and engaged employees, will be twice to three times that of the peer organizations who do not have highly engaged and committed employees. We are talking about a great deal of money. In short, you cannot succeed in a competitive environment without highly committed and engaged employees. How will we increase people's sense of commitment and engagement? Number one, you have to work at getting the relationships between employees and their boss as good as possible, because as Gallup says, people join an organization and they quit their boss. And that sense of disenchantment with the boss begins within the first 6 months. So, what is it you need to do? You have to realize that people who are not in decision-making positions are still fountains of experience and knowledge and skill. That education, which currently moves people into high-ranking decision-making, after school, but without a great deal of experience, are two populations who normally have nothing to do with each other. And it is very easy for the educated group move swiftly into decision-making roles to feel a lack of respect or trust or even contempt for the non-educated group. And what you really need to do is severalfold. A, the military does this best. Have a belief system that says ordinary, which simply means non-educated people, have all kinds of potential as long as you behave toward them as though they do. And you will be surprised at how many people will become skillful and leaders, or already are. You have to be willing to work at creating situations in which these two groups of people work together to solve issues with skills that are relevant, on problems that are important. And in this problem-solving activity, different forms of leadership will emerge. And that will depend on what part of the problem you are working on. Your goal is to increase mutual communication, respect, and trust for both of the populations. We are giving groups of people all kinds of stuff that common sense says they need and they want, but you know what? Need and want, when it's not important to you today, carries very little weight.
Yeah.
It's insignificant. You've come to take it for granted. So if giving everybody identical stuff, because it's good stuff, gets you no place.
That's right.
What's the next option? Do the work of finding out what Judy Bardwick or Dave Summers most needs or wants today and perhaps for the next year or two.
Right.
And this is called customizing working conditions or rewards. And I can just hear the people saying, that's not fair. Fair is everybody gets the same. Well, that's what we've grown up with. But how about now, fair is everyone has the opportunity to choose what is most important to them. That's fair. And the other thing I always hear is, that is impossible, which is a polite phrase for Judy, you are a jerk. This is impossible. You're going to get millions of things that people want. Well, that's not true. At any moment in time, just a few things come to the surface that people want a lot. So I published a book called The Plateauing Trap in 1986, I think. So from 86 to 95, when I lectured about plateauing, and I'd say to people, what do you really need from your work in order for you to feel really satisfied? Just call it out. I'll write it down. Mm-hmm. I'd get 30 to 50 responses, but I could always put them in four categories. The first category was always challenge, autonomy, success, and the last one was always money.
Right.
But then from 95 to 01, when there was much more money than good ideas around.
yes, there was things were out of whack back then.
I had a former partner who made a lot of money because he kept being fired and he got increasing amounts of severance pay.
Sort of just, the stair-step catapult
type of thing. Yes, it was hysterical. Well, it's funny in retrospect. But anyway, so from the period from 1995 to 01, then the two things that people most wanted was, no surprise, money, and second, autonomy. At the current time, I think there are six categories that people want. The first three are very old, and we've heard variations on this for years. People want to be successful. Now they want to be reasonably secure, which they never said before because they were secure. And the third old motivator right now is to keep learning, which is a, or people often say, continuous challenge. People don't want to spend their life doing the same thing forever. So these are three very familiar categories of desires. And now we have three new ones, which are highly influenced, I believe, by the young boomers and Gen X. And that is, I want both my work and my family to flourish. That is the balanced life coming to the forefront. I want to like and respect my colleagues and bosses. And this was a great surprise to me because I learned work and family were distinctly different and you didn't spill one over into the other. But boomers and Gen X want to be able to play with their colleagues. And lastly, to find meaning in my life and my work. In other words, I do not want to do work as a 50-hour-a-week thing that is just to bring money home and get a house, et cetera, et cetera. I want it to have a greater meaning to me.
Judith, can you give me some examples of what we were just talking about?
Sure. For example, if somebody says, I'm really feeling stuck, I want to keep on challenging myself. So what might we offer? We could offer changes in the content of the work you do or the place where you do it or your specific responsibilities. We could ask if you would be interested in developing interpersonal skills as differentiated from your regular professional skills. We might bring college classes or skill classes on site, and people could take them at convenient times, and so on. We might also ask, would you be comfortable, and now we would have levels of risk,
okay,
and a person could choose something from an itty-bitty step to a major giant step,
right?
Okay, and so on. So each of the six categories that I'm suggesting has a long list of possible ways in which it could take place. But I repeat again, every organization should customize through their own interviews and analyses and be sure that what you're offering is really potent to your work people.
Exactly. One size does not fit all.
No, not at all anymore.
The name of the book is One Foot Out the Door. The author is Dr. Judith Bardwick. And Judith, I'd like to thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure.
Remember, we love to get your feedback, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. One of our listeners will receive either a $200 discount on an AMA seminar or a free copy of One Foot Out the Door. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.